forgiving seven times? Well, that's more than generous. But Jesus answers, forgive 70 times seven. How you like them numbers? We don't. Jesus is advocating forgiveness that's over the top. Forgiveness, not as a procedure, a policy, but a way of life.
That's Reverend Dr. Will Willimon, and today he brings us good news in his sermon, Unlimited Forgiveness. I'm Katie Givens-Keim. So glad you're with us. Welcome to Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. It's so great to have you with us. Today on Day One, we're so honored to welcome back the one and only Reverend Dr. Will Willimon, professor of the practice of Christian ministry at Duke Divinity School in Durham, North Carolina, where he also served for 20 years as dean of Duke University Chapel. He's a retired bishop in the United Methodist Church and the author of more than 100 books on ministry and preaching, including The Church We Carry, Loss, Leadership, and the Future of Our Church from Abingdon Press. Also from Abingdon, The Last Supper, Conversations That Led to the Cross. It's a profound 6-week Lenten study that explores the parables and stories Jesus told at tables along the way to his final meal. Will has been a familiar voice to both listeners of Day One and the Protestant Hour for many years, and we're so glad to welcome him back today. Will Willimon, we are beyond thrilled to welcome you back to Day One.
It is great to be here.
There's so many things to say about you and your preaching and your career and your ministry. I'm going to actually talk about your daughter for a minute. Harriet Willimon Putman, director of events and senior producer of the Everything Happens Project, which is, of course, Kate Bowler's Everything Happens podcast. I want the world to know she came and just gave us fantastic wisdom as we were figuring out how to be a remote broadcast. And so, my goodness, you Willimons, the whole bunch of you are a valuable and beloved lot.
Oh, well, thank you. She's a treasure and good theologian in her own right.
Love it. Well, I did not know something about your relationship with Day One. As a young preacher, you apparently put a cassette recorder beside the radio to record the Protestant Hour.
Preaching is a craft, I believe. And how do you learn to do a craft? Well, you learn by watching a crafts person, somebody experienced in the art. The trouble is, in those days for preachers, you never got to hear any other preachers. So I would get up in the morning, put my cassette tape recorder up next to the radio and get to hear the Protestant Hour. People like Edmund Stimley and Kenneth Goodson and John Van Orsdal, these great preachers of the past. And then I would take that cassette, and as I was driving to the hospital or a neighboring county to visit somebody, I would play those tapes again and again. So I am in a great debt to Day One. And today I say to budding preachers, Day One is a great resource to get to hear other people articulating the gospel. And you can get to look over their shoulders and learn to preach. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Now that we have a land and an internet that it has practically every sermon available everywhere, how do you suggest people sort that? We like to think that Day One helps curate a diverse array of preaching voices, but it's just so different for preachers now. Now it's a cacophony and a chaos of preaching you can hear.
If I were asked to put my finger on what has changed in preaching, it is now through the internet, a preacher can listen to many preachers. This morning, walking my dog, I listened to 3 sermons. One of them, Alf Deutsch from Switzerland. That's just amazing. I advise young preachers, just roam about on the web. I'm also impressed how many lay people will tell me that in a given week, they will listen to three or four sermons. Listeners of day one, I'm talking about many of you. And they said, I love, for instance, taking a biblical text, perhaps a text that's assigned in the lectionary that week, and hearing how three or four different preachers will relate to that text. And that's wonderful. And sometimes one can hear sermons that one thinks, wow, I'm glad my preacher doesn't talk like that. So it's a wonderful gift.
Love it. Is it true that you actually advised Vanna White not to go pursue her dream of acting?
Yes, that is on my record. In fact, as 20 years as chaplain at Duke, I would be leaning on a student and saying, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Look at you. You disgust me. And the student would sometimes respond, aren't you the guy that tried to talk Vanna White out of a career in TV? And I said, yes, that is true. However, in your case, we had our little church in North Myrtle Beach, Trinity United Methodist Church. We had a little baccalaureate service for all the high school graduates. And afterwards, I was saying, well, Vanna, what are your plans? And she said, I've just put down $500 to go to a modeling school in Atlanta. And I said, what? Vanna, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard of. Those schools are, they take young girls' money, and nobody ever gets a job in modeling after those schools. Can you get the money back? And I see you as like in nursing or something. And Vanna said, well, my dream is to go into TV. And I said, Vanna, we all love you. That won't be possible for you. TV, no, and Hollywood, no. And said, well, that's my dream. Anyway, I came over and I told Patsy, I said, that poor Vanna White, she has paid $500 for this. About 8 years later, we visited in Hollywood. The children were young, and we went to the Wheel of Fortune. And Pat Sajak comes out and says, well, I understand we have Vanna's pastor with us here today. And I thought, oh, my career could end here. And but that evening, Vanna graciously informed me that she made more in 1 week taping Wheel of Fortune than I made in 1 year giving advice to adolescents. People in my church. So I feel like the Lord has repaid me for that. So,
oh, I love that story. So am I right in saying that your call to ministry crystallized not in a chapel, but in over a straight bourbon in an Amsterdam bar? Is that true?
You have looked at my memoir, Accidental Preacher. Yeah, I was a sophomore in college. Bumming around Europe with some other students and ran into the legendary Baptist preacher from Charlotte, Carlisle Marney. Dr. Marney had pity on me and took me to a bar in Amsterdam, and where he proceeded to order two bourbons. I had never had bourbon. So he asked me, what are you doing in Europe? And I said, looking for girls, roaming around. And Dr. Marney said, son, I've been a preacher for years, and I know when somebody's lying to me. What are you here really for? And I said, oh, I've been thinking something crazy about maybe possibly trying maybe a year in seminary. Why would that be stupid? And so I told him a little bit about my background, and when he heard about it, he said, well, I'll tell you, this has got Jesus' fingerprints all over it, son. Let me tell you, I believe we're talking about a vocation here. I think we're talking about a call. And I just remember that as an important moment. One of the things I said was, I feel like, you know, maybe this is some kind of psychological reaction to my absentee father. Maybe I'm trying to deal with that by thinking of this heavenly father who's summoning me to this work. And Marnie said, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, look, Jesus will ride in on anything, and said he loves to take daddy problems, mama problems, and leverage those to his advantage. And I said, wow, I guess I don't know that much about Jesus.
Wow. All right. Well, swinging to the other half of life, I've heard you say there is no retirement from discipleship. So I'm curious, what assignment has God given Will Willimon in this season that you did not expect?
Well, that's a great question, because I think aging is experienced by many of us as a time of loss. Things are being taken away from us, our jobs, our mobility for many, our friends and loved ones depart. But it's good to be reminded this is also a time of receiving gifts. And one of the gifts I think I've received is a kind of freedom. I don't think I felt overly constricted by my vocation or my job or my boss or people's opinions about things. But I have realized in retirement, there have been those moments someone has said something to me and I've thought, okay, if I were 45, I might let that pass and just say, that's an interesting thought. But now that I'm 80, I say, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. And let me tell you why that's dumb. And you may never speak to me again after this conversation, but that's okay, because I don't have that much time anyway. And so there's a kind of joyful freedom. Things that maybe you were worried about, concerned about before, now you're not concerned about. I was having breakfast with a friend this morning who's my age, and he said, doesn't it feel good to have lived past the age when your departure, your death, will be a tragedy? You know, nobody can stand up at my funeral now and say, oh, it's just such a tragedy, his life, he's left us too soon. There'll be more people there who's saying, boy, he took his time about leaving. I mean, even now as we speak, the dean of the Divinity School is outside my office saying, weren't you supposed to be out by now? And I said, well, I'm recording a day one thing. I'm leaving right after that. Well, fine. Yeah. So it is a gift that the majority of the world's people don't get.
Yeah.
And so I'm enjoying this time of life.
Yeah. Will, you had a fantastic interview with PBS in 2021. And back then, 5 years ago, you suggested that in terms of the political polarities, the great divisions wrenching the United States of America apart, that it may partly mean that more people have finally reached the microphone than before. Do you think that still 5 years later? And how do we make room for voices that were excluded before without confusing every amplified voice from both extremes with the truth?
Well, you earlier used the word cacophony. I think it feels like we're getting lots of conflicted voices, lots of loud voices, and people, you know, sitting at a desk in a newsroom and they're yelling into the microphone, you know, have you heard what he's done? You know, and to me, as Christians, particularly as a Christian communicator, as a pastor, preacher, I would say, I wonder, is there any word from the Lord here? What is the Lord saying at this time? And I think always to be reminded that even particularly in a time of conflict and difficulty, we know from Scripture, the Lord loves to show up at times like that with a word. Your exile will not be long. It'll be hard, but it won't be long. Or eventually there will be homecoming. Eventually I shall comfort you, be with you. Blessed are those who are hungry, because eventually you will be filled, satisfied. So we work under that promise. Also, sometimes, if I say to you, I've never been so in such despair over the state of constitutional democracy, maybe that's a time for you to say, well, maybe God is delivering you of your early subservience and idolatry to American constitutional democracy. And that's not a tragedy. That's considered to be a good thing. That happens all the time with the living God. So it could be that that maybe we're in a time that's an opportunity for us to refocus and to rethink. I began a sermon during Lent, Christian season for penitence, for confession of sin. And I said, normally in Lent, I have a hard job as a preacher because I got to convince you that you're a sinner, even though you presume to be a really nice person who does the best you can do. So Lent can be hard for preachers. However, this Lent, you're fresh from electing a convicted criminal, serial adulterer as your leader. So we've got that out of the way now. You need help. You need saving. You need forgiving. Let's go, folks. We got that kind of God who loves to deal with our mess ups. Some of them took that the wrong way, but well.
Well, what are your thoughts about how we handle conflict these days?
My last book was on my home church that went through division and conflict and decided to leave the denomination. And my book was a study of those dynamics. Division is painful. In a church, division is often seen as a sign that we're not the church that Jesus expects us to be. However, that should be said alongside the observation that Jesus' entire ministry was characterized by constant conflict, division, argumentation. Jesus seemed to never walk away from an argument. He seemed to start a lot of arguments. He seemed also not to be that interested in resolving arguments, that somehow resolution of the argument and agreement would not deter his mission. He went on and saved the world anyway, even though much of the world resisted him. So I have said, if there are divisive issues, if there are hot button topics that are just very difficult for people to, and dangerous in a group to discuss because it could cause greater division and all. If there are such topics, I think I could make a case that should be discussed nowhere but in church. The U.S. Senate has no philosophical, theological means of discussing that without killing each other off. A Duke University classroom lacks the means to say, let's talk about this, let's be honest, let's try to listen and hear one another, and then let's continue together as a group. But the church is under that mandate. And in the church, in effect, we say every Sunday, okay, folks, let's put some potentially divisive, difficult topics on the table for discussion, the sermon. But we all promise that no matter how painful and uncomfortable this conversation is, we'll all join one another at the Lord's table together. That's a gift at the present moment that I hope churches will enjoy.
Now listen for God's word as we hear from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 18, verses 21 through 33.
Peter came and said to Jesus, Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as seven times? Jesus said to him, not seven times, but I tell you, 77 times. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he began the reckoning, the one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. And as he could not pay, his lord ordered him to be sold together with his wife and children and all his possessions, and payment to be made. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, oh, have patience with me, and I will pay you everything. And out of pity for him, the lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. But that same slave, as he went out, came upon one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him by the throat, he said, "Pay what you owe." Then his fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, "Oh, have patience with me, and I will pay you." But he refused. Then he went and threw him into prison until he would pay the debt. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their lord all that had taken place. Then his lord summoned him and said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?"
Now, Reverend Dr. Will Willimon's sermon entitled Unlimited Forgiveness.
I'm grateful that my mother raised me with a deep sense of right and wrong. I don't mean to brag, but as a preacher, I've never been afraid to speak up for justice, for right, for goodness. Now, there may be more accommodated, nervous little preachers who are fearful to call out some politician for his lies, his adultery, or his greed. Oh, but not I, because wrong is wrong. Debts must be paid. I want people to get what they deserve, especially when they've hurt me or others. Forgiveness, sure, but not if it lets someone get off too easily. Not if forgiveness means allowing someone to get away with doing something for which they should be punished. Because, well, debts must be paid. Unpaid debts must be punished. Justice! So when Peter asked Jesus, "How many times should I forgive?" As many as 7? At first, I resist. 7 times? But then, upon further reflection, I say, you know, why not? I mean, we're Christians. Forgive them once. If they do it again, give them a second chance. And if they wrong you a third time, well, some people are slow to get the point. Forgive them a fourth time. Goodness takes time. And for some, goodness doesn't come naturally. They haven't had the advantages that I've had. So forgiving again, forgiving 7 times, well, that's more than generous. But Jesus answers, not 7. Forgive 70 times 7. How you like them numbers? We don't. Do the numbers. Jesus is advocating forgiveness that's over the top. Forgiveness, not as a procedure, a policy, but a way of life. Forgive 70 times 7? Well, a person could go around all day and do nothing but forgiving. While we're still recovering from the shock of that 70 times 7, Jesus wallops us with a story about a servant who owes 10,000 talents. How much is that? I'll tell you. Let me do the numbers. 150,000 years of wages. Bigger than the national debt. An absurd, cosmic, comic, over-the-top, laughable amount this guy owes. It's an impossible debt to pay back. An impossible debt to forgive. Act 1 in the story, the servant pleads for mercy. It's kind of an absurd thing to ask, considering the size of the debt. And the king forgives it all. What? No questions? No installment plan? Just wild, reckless, over-the-top forgiveness? Then we come to Act 2. That same servant, fresh from being extravagantly forgiven, grabs a fellow servant by the throat over a debt of just a few bucks. "Pay me what you owe," he threatens. The king, who had forgiven the servant a huge debt, was, Jesus says, displeased. Forgive others, Jesus says, in the same ridiculously extravagant, reckless way that God has forgiven you. The story implies that Jesus says, hey, look, when you are wrong, remember, I've forgiven you of a huge debt, your wrongs against me. Now, Why don't you try forgiving those who run up comparatively small debts to you? 70 times 7? Is Jesus serious? I tell you, you go around forgiving debts, injustice, wrongdoing, these crooks are going to think that the wrongdoing is okay for them to do it, and they'll just do wrong again. Debts must be paid. Wrongs must be admitted and set right. There are limits, boundaries on how much someone should be expected to forgive. There are some wrongs that are so horribly wrong that forgiveness of the wrong is wrong. Mercy has its limits, no matter what Jesus says. Jesus, give us a list of the wrongs that are so wrong that they don't qualify for mercy. What would you say are the crimes and misdemeanors that are really out of bounds for forgiveness? Jesus, let's see your list. Mercy is fine, I say, as long as the perpetrator is sorry for what he's done. Forgiveness, yes, if the bad guy does time and is appropriately penitent. Jesus, give us a reasonable limit on how much we ought to forgive. Let's be merciful. 7 times? How you like those numbers? And Jesus responds, 70 times 7 times. Extravagant, limitless, over the top, forgiveness. How you like those numbers? I heard a scholar of world religions, Houston Smith, was asked at a gathering at Duke, after studying all the great religions of the world, have you noted things that those religions have in common, but what's the one thing that Christianity has that's unknown in other faiths? Smith thought a moment and then he responded, forgiveness. No other faith teaches forgiveness of enemies. Forgiveness 70 times 7 times. St. Augustine noted in his church in 4th century North Africa, when the congregation said the Lord's Prayer, and they came to that phrase in the Lord's Prayer, and forgive us our debts as we forgive the debts of others, the congregation would go silent and then resume, and lead us not into temptation. At least they knew, said Augustine, that they had no intention of forgiving others as they had been forgiven. So they knew they had no right to pray as Jesus taught. Oh, of all the uplifting spiritual thoughts of Jesus, all the noble things he could say to us, why wallop us with this over-the-top story with these ridiculous numbers? I'm just an ordinary, limited person. I'm having trouble forgiving the family who left my congregation in a huff over a sermon I preached that they didn't like. Jesus expects me to forgive 70 times 7 families who don't like my preaching? Well, I mean, I do nothing all day but just forgive all day long. 22 years ago, a mechanic in my hometown, Greenville, South Carolina, jilted me out of $400. That was a week's salary. He never paid me back. My response? When going up or down I-85, I drive 30 miles out of the way just so I don't have to come anywhere close to that guy's garage. Why would Jesus tell me this story? 70 times 7? To which I hear Jesus reply, try it. Forgive in the same manner as I have forgiven you. I've forgiven you of the crimes against me far greater than anybody has committed against you. Come on, I'll help you be the merciful forgiver I've created you to be. I preached on this very text this week, years ago. And after the service, a woman comes out of church and she stands by the church door and she says, "Do you mean to tell me that my abusive husband, who made my life hell for 15 years, whom I finally got the guts to walk out on, Jesus expects me to forgive him?" Well, I went into the usual defensive mode that we preachers have. Spouse abuse is a horrible evil, and I certainly couldn't tell you to forgive. We only have about 15 minutes for these sermons, so I couldn't qualify everything appropriately. But Jesus did say to forgive our enemies, and I can't think of a bigger enemy than your ex. And though I wouldn't necessarily say, he did say 70 times 7, and that's a whole lot of forgiveness. So it kind of does sound like Jesus on a bad day. And she stood up to her full 5'2", and she said, "Thanks, just checking." Afterwards, as I divested in my study, Jesus spoke to me. "Now, who told you that you were to protect her from me? When you look at her, all you see is a victim." "Oh, you're a victim. Contort your voice into a whine. Keep your head down. All moral responsibility is off your shoulders, you poor thing." But Jesus said, "When I look at her, I see one of my disciples. I'm fixing to turn the world upside down through her. She and I are going to put things right side up. If you'll just get out of the way and let me talk to her as I please." When I said 70 times 7, who told you that I was kidding?
Our preacher today was the Reverend Dr. Will Willimon. For a free transcript of his sermon, Unlimited Forgiveness, you can visit us online at dayone.org. That's D-A-Y, the number one, .org. Now, if today's sermon maybe had you thinking about somebody you've driven 30 miles out of your way to avoid, well then, we'd love to hear from you. I'd love to know that I have a friend. Here in Atlanta, our phone number is 404-490-3354. That's 404-490-3354. It's a voicemail line, so there's no pressure and no small talk. Just leave us your message, and we'll hear it the same day. And since we're being honest with you today, here's a little truth of our own. Day One runs a small team doing a lot with a little. If we can't keep doing it without you, would you consider making a gift at dayone.org/donate? That's D-A-Y, the number one, .org/donate. Every gift helps us keep bringing voices like Will Willimon into your car, your kitchen, your headphones, and your Sunday morning. Prefer pen, paper, and a stamp? You can also choose to mail your gift to Day One, 4062 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite A629, Atlanta, Georgia 30319. And if the Day One E newsletter isn't already living in your inbox, well, let's fix that right now. Every Wednesday, it lands with a preview of the coming Sunday's sermon and preacher, plus reflections, lectionary resources, interview clips, and news from around Day One. No spam, no fine print, just good stuff once a week. Grab your phone right now and text DAY, the number one, to 844-946-2479. That's 844-946-2479. And congratulations, you're signed up. Next week on Day One, as autumn settles into ordinary time, we welcome back Reverend Dr. Amy Moiso of the Presbyterian Church USA in Louisville, Kentucky, with a sermon called Subverting Expectations. Drawing on a memory from junior high and a teacher who upended every assumption about consequences, Amy delves into Luke 14 and asks, what happens when we stop drawing lines between us and them and start believing that Jesus stands on every side of that line? Subverting Expectations with Reverend Dr. Amy Moiso. That's next week on Day One. What a Will Willimon trademark, fantastic sermon. I experienced that to be, and I believe I will not be alone. You mentioned something when we were setting up here about a way you went to humor, particularly in this sermon. Would you say more about that?
I blame it on Jesus. It was Jesus who told this ridiculous story. I mean, this crazy parable about the unforgiving servant. It's either a parable about the unforgiving servant or the ridiculously forgiving master. But nevertheless, Jesus tells it in an exaggerated way. I'm just sure when Jesus told this story, there were people rolling in the aisles because it's so exaggerated and all. I wanted to catch up a bit of that. Also, and this is so typical of Jesus' parables, he really doesn't resolve it. He doesn't tie it all up in the end.
No.
He doesn't seem to feel any need to answer all the questions. In fact, the parable seems to have as its purpose to provoke a bunch of questions, to end without a solution, without an ending. And just to say, hey, folks, here's a story about the way God is, the way the world is, the way you are. Frankly, I've just endured listening to a sermon by a preacher who felt the need to say to us, in effect, now, I know none of you know what I'm talking about, and all of you are limited in your ability to use your brains. So let me go over this one more time again. Let me repeat. Let me explain to you. Here's what you're supposed to be thinking about this sermon. I love it that Jesus never does that. He lays that story on you, and then if you say, well, Jesus, wait a minute. What is that supposed to be? A typical response is, if you got ears, listen, if you don't got ears, well, here's another story. Try this one. I love that.
Yes, I love it too. There's lots of memorable characters in this sermon, but you said, when going up and down I-85, I drive 30 miles out of the way just so I don't have to come anywhere close to that guy's garage. So my question is, have you forgiven the mechanic yet? And what would forgiveness actually require?
Well, Jesus uses hyperbole in his parables, and maybe I use hyperbole, but I think there's so little forgiveness because forgiveness is costly. We tend to experience it as painful. I think Jesus is reminding us, hey, if God can forgive you, you ought to be able to forgive anybody when you think of the ways you have pained God, and yet God is able to look down from the cross and say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. They've never known what they're doing. They don't know. But that's an amazing way to kind of end a ministry that Jesus does on the cross. We live under that. In my concluding story about the woman, and by the way, mm-hmm. that I reported that story to you just as it happened, what I heard in that story was, hey, maybe in saying you forgive others as I've forgiven you, maybe that was a marvelous affirmation of us. And we say to Jesus, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just a human being. I'm an ordinary person. I'm sorry, I'm no saint. I cannot do that. Maybe Jesus believes in us more than we believe in ourselves in saying, forgive them like I've forgiven you. And so maybe in my lack of forgiveness of the wrongs that others commit against me, maybe I'm missing some of the beauty of my humanity and my own discipleship.
Mm. This reminds me of another story I know of yours, that you were a boy and you watched your church reject Billy Graham's crusade because Graham refused to segregate the audience. Afterward, you found your pastor alone and weeping. Oh my goodness. There's private grief. There's institutional sin.
Yeah.
How forgiveness works in there, but first getting things right.
I've wondered, I was a teenager at the time that I witnessed that. And I wonder if the pastor ever individually went to people at that meeting and said, I want you to know I was very hurt and disappointed that we couldn't do this. Or did the pastor try to reach some accommodation, some compromise? I don't know. I do know that that's often the way it is in church or in life, that things don't have resolutions. They're ragged, they're broken, and we pick up and go on. And I bet that's what my pastor probably did. He continued to be a pastor, I know that. And that's sad. And Jesus, I think, gives us the opportunity to create, to impact, to reconcile, to forgive. And yet he does that saying, know that I forgive you when you're unable to do that, unable to resolve, unable to reconcile. I've wondered when Jesus says, forgive 70 times seven, maybe Jesus sighed and said, because dealing with you, I know that's what I'm going to have to do for you. So, you know, and Karl Barth said something like, the sins of non-Christians are so puny, they're hardly worth bothering with. The sins of Christians, though, when you get a God who says, forgive your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, don't turn anybody away who asks, it means that Jesus produces a lot of sinners who didn't know they were sinners till we met Jesus and found out about his way. So we're all grateful that we have a merciful, forgiving God.
Oh, thanks be to God. Okay, another line just loved from your sermon was, debts must be paid. Unpaid debts must be punished. Justice! How do we balance our important, valuable hunger for justice and for treatment of people, which desperately needs to be aligned with how they are children of God, and then our less noble desire to see someone we dislike punished?
Well, you know, I think the parable is helpful here in that the parable to me really cuts against human self-righteousness and presumption. And I notice with a lot of my fellow preachers, they're big on justice, they say. You know, one thing, you know, stand up in a pulpit and say, I'm a spokesperson for justice. I'm going to be prophetic and speak up for justice. Well, there's a lot of implications there. One is, I'm just, and so now I'm going to help you with your injustice. There's a kind of arrogant superiority there that is troubling. There's also that sense of I'm apart from the problems that I'm dealing with. I heard two sermons on the row in which preachers in different ways attempted to address racial injustice, which is a subject, I think, dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. But the first sermon was basically a recitation of all of the sins of the white church against the black church and racial injustice. And the preacher said, this sermon may be painful and fine. White America has got to be honest and all. And of course, the implication is, I'm being very honest with you right now. Why don't you model yourself after me? The second sermon, the pastor just got up and said, this sermon is confessional. I was raised in a home in which all people were valued, my mother taught me, had playmates of other races. My mother worked hard to make that possible. And yet, even though I know that's who I want to be and ought to be, here's some times when I failed. And his text was Paul saying, the good that I would do, I cannot do. Mm. I can will what is right, but I can't do. It was just powerful. Wow. Because the preacher invited us into that recognition And I know it as 20 years preaching at Duke Chapel, I became nervous when I would preach a sermon and someone would come out and say, oh, that was a great sermon, very courageous too. And I just thank God that I go to a church like Duke Chapel where the preachers preach the social justice like you do, not like most of these other churches in town. And I'm thinking, that's Jesus could have some problems with that. As Paul says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory God intends.
Yes.
And therefore, God is going to have mercy on all.
Yes. And it seems there's a difference between standing in the pulpit and preaching as a Christian versus standing in the pulpit and preaching for justice.
Yeah.
As a Christian has the depth and potentially, I'm hearing you say, humility to own the frailty and the grace from God and to name it as a collaborator.
Yeah, you know, in Jesus' parable in the sermon, I presume it could be rather controversial, and I presume there are people who could take grave offense at my concluding illustration and say, wait a minute, are you implying that somehow the way to deal with spouse abuse is forgiveness? Well, you know, I think the way to deal with spouse abuse is incarceration, is punishment.
Community intervention, for sure.
And I think of all those people who have suffered horribly, mostly women, due to such abuse. And yet, I wanted to catch up some of the outrageousness of Jesus. When Jesus says, be merciful to those who wrong you, that's a horrible thing to say to people who've been wronged. And yet, Jesus says it. And then I kind of like the way when Jesus ends that parable, and I say, whoa, Jesus, now, are you talking about like Nazis? Jesus, wait, are you talking about a child abuser? And I kind of hear Jesus says, let the arguments begin. This is what's called church. This is where you wrestle with what did Jesus mean by this? Was he talking to us? What about so-and-so? What about so-and-so? I know when I was in a tirade in a sermon, maybe I said something negative about the present administration.
Perhaps.
Maybe I said something about critical of the present first family. Maybe.
Perhaps.
At the end of the service, and I was kind of proud of myself about, hey, I'm calling an ace, I'm naming it, you know. And it was about immigration and all. An older adult, a woman came out and said, thanks for the sermon. I'm really glad that you spoke out. We've needed that. And she said, so you're pretty positive that God is unable to do any good thing through the present Trump administration. Is that, you're kind of convinced of that? And I thought, that'll make, keep moving. I don't want to hear that.
Keep going.
And I said to the Holy Spirit, you know, you put her up to that.
Yeah.
That just sounded like just like something you would say. But I was so thankful. Thank the Lord. I was preaching in a church where someone took responsibility for me and saying, good sermon. However, does that nullify God's grace and mercy for all? Great question. And talking like Jesus, which preachers try to do, is a challenging and wonderful task. And I can say after six decades of this kind of stuff, I can still say that Jesus still surprises me and still is kind of the most interesting thing the church has to talk about.
Oh, beautifully said. All right, Will, what are you hearing from the living Christ now that you most want today's preachers and listeners of preaching and even this whole day one listening audience to hear?
I think it's the word that I myself would want to hear, and that is, I am busy reconciling my rebellious world to myself. I will succeed ultimately in getting back what belongs to me. And the good news is, you belong to me, and I am not going to rest until that occurs. Therein is our hope, and that's the good news.
Yes, that is such good news indeed. Oh, Will Willimon, we're so glad you're back at day one, and we can't wait for the next time. Thank you so much.
Me too. Thank you, Katie.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 80 years, proclaiming God's hope to a hurting and divided world. 80 years is a whole lot of Sundays, and we're grateful to God for every one. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media. You can visit us anytime at dayone.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. May the grace of God be with you on day one and every day yet to come.